Hello, and a warm welcome to Season 6 of Brown Don't Frown podcast. Our first episode went live back in October 2019, and since then, BDF has brought over 40 episodes featuring almost 50 guests and their stories straight to you. I hope you've been able to learn from them as much as I have. I am your host, Tanya Hardcastle. Brown Don't Frown spotlights the experiences of a diverse range of women and brings new perspectives. Season 6 is about empowerment and empathy through various lenses, such as navigating our 30s, not just reaching life goals and milestones, but also making new ones, parenthood and reproductive health, spinning plates, challenges, fears, surviving, thriving, finding purpose and intention, gratitude, balance, calm and rest. We've got some inspiring women, including fellow South Asian podcasters, an acclaimed novelist, a reproductive health campaigner and charity founder, and a co-director of a South Asian women's empowerment initiative. If any of that interests you, stick around and see what we have to offer. You might learn or discover something new. The BDF community has grown so much over the last 4.5 years. Thank you to all of you who've subscribed to the podcast and left us a review. As an independent podcaster, that means a lot to me. And if you want to stay updated on the latest news, podcast episodes and exclusives, then you can sign up to the newsletter by clicking the link in the episode notes. That's all from me for now. Enjoy Season 6. So our guest today is Gabby Stewart. So Gabby, I've known you as a colleague and a friend for a while now, and this I hope doesn't come as a surprise to you, but I think I mentioned this to you before, you know, when I joined the organisation where we currently both work, you know, I just got married, I was sort of on the fence about having children at the time, and I just remember observing your sort of energy and enthusiasm and passion at work, you know, while juggling at the time two children, and I really admired it. And in many ways, you know, it was quite empowering seeing that in practice at my place of work. And you know, I sort of had that in, as a consideration when I then came to think about starting my own family. So I just thought today would be a good opportunity to hear a bit more about your journey as a parent, as a person as well, of course, and just navigating all the other challenges and opportunities life throws at us. And on that note, I'm going to hand over to you, Gabby, to introduce yourself. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on. This is really exciting. It's a real pleasure to be invited. So I have three children now, so they're 8, 5, and 1. And it's quite interesting because I feel like with the older one, we're sort of getting out of the young child stage and looking towards sort of helping them navigate the world on their own a little bit while equally still being down in weaning and toddlering and all of that as well. So it's interesting to see mothering and childcare raising from both sides of the spectrum. It also means that I've got quite a lot of experience of what it's like trying to juggle workplace and family life as well. I think I've worked every iteration of flexible part-time, full-time, compressed hours that there is. So I certainly feel like I've gone through the battleground on that, and the word journey certainly applies.
Yeah, sounds like it, definitely. And it'll be so interesting to hear a bit more about that today as well. But just to begin with then, I mean, obviously you've got three children and originally you're from New Zealand. And I just wanted to touch base a little bit around sort of generational traditions in pregnancy and motherhood. You know, how have various expectations and ways of life in these phases evolved since the time of our grandmothers and mothers, for example? I mean, for me, like one thing I observed is, or have observed through the last couple of generations, so like when I think back to my mum and then my grandma, like how they sort of behaved and their sort of priorities while they were pregnant, and then obviously after having children, is the definition of like self-care. I feel like it's really evolved. Like at my mum's time and my grandma's time, it was very much like rest, you know, don't do too much movement, just relax, let people come to you, let other people do things for you, you know, put your feet up. But my experience was, you know, very different. It was very much like keep moving, keep active, like keep working, that kind of thing. And over time, like just general sort of expectations have changed, obviously, over the last, you know, 30, 40 years, even longer than that, if we talk about, you know, our grandparents. So it would be really interesting to know a bit more about that from your perspective, and what you think has changed for the better or for the worse.
Yeah, I think it's quite interesting having an experience where I was actually raising my children away from a lot of family or direct influence. Like we're lucky that we've got the ability to talk to them on a daily basis, but not being in that space with everyone, it was kind of like I felt like I also had a little bit of freedom to figure out what was right for us.
Yes.
And so in that sense, it was both, you know, quite daunting to do it on our own, but also a little bit liberating as well. One of the interesting things that my mother-in-law asked me when I was pregnant with my third child was, you know, what can pregnant women do and can't do these days? You don't really hear about it. And I thought that was really interesting because obviously when they went through it, everything was sort of common knowledge, perhaps probably around the time when they were told that you can't smoke anymore, you can't drink anymore, which they'd done in the early mid 80s, you know, and that sort of advice was perhaps coming through when they were really exposed to it and it was really public knowledge. And I thought, well, that all that advice of what you can and can't do is out there if you know where to go. And it's the segmentation of perhaps targeted social media, who you're following, what algorithms you've got on, how online you are, as to how exposed you are. And our parents, they were probably told by everybody, it was everybody's consciousness to tell them what they could or could not do. But today I could go and find you a dozen different views on what you can do and what's a good idea and what's not a good idea if you believe it strongly enough. So I think a lot of it now is perhaps, I think a lot of what I was thinking about before today's session is around the confidence to be okay with your own decision-making without having to be really regimented about it. You know, we're seeing radicalization across loads of different topic areas, and parenting and birthing and pregnancy is no different. So, you know, like, what foods you can eat, you know, people will always have a view on that, but you know, where's the empirical evidence for it, and how much do we run our lives on that in other areas of our aspects, but we're expected to sort of live quite a restrained side while pregnant, which I think was interesting. I think the being active is a really big one. You know, I've had friends who've just found pregnancy really awful and really hard, and the idea of getting out and doing anything is actually too much. And so it's another burden if you're being told do something. I quite liked being out and about, and it didn't affect me quite that severely. So I could be out and about and really active, but
it depends on the person and their experience of pregnancy as well.
Very much so. And we should trust them, I think, to be able to make the best call for themselves. I remember there was another example, my first pregnancy, and I went and staged the night at a friend's house. And again, there was, you know, some of the parents' generation thought that was completely unacceptable that a pregnant woman would go and stay the night at her friend's house. I mean, it was nowhere near the end of the pregnancy. And I couldn't, like, that was completely foreign to me that wouldn't be okay. Or the expectation that my husband should have a problem with it. And it's just those kind of old societal expectations perhaps are quite different.
They are different.
And maybe, you know, maybe there's a little bit of, I had to go through all of this. Why don't you?
That's true. That's very true. Especially with the sort of whole flexible working post-pandemic, I think that's changed so much, and it's given, you know, working parents, a serious sort of revolution, really, if you like, in terms of just being able to flex working, being able to stay in the, you know, not having to dip out of their careers, you know, being able to maintain that momentum through that opportunity. And that's amazing. And yeah, as you say, there are, you know, certain people I've spoken to, like, you know, parents' generation saying, you know, I never got to do that. I had to take time off, or you know, it wasn't economically feasible, you know, for me to do this X, Y, Z, but you can, because, you know, you've got flexible working. So there is that to think about as well. And interesting, you mentioned, like, not having those traditions so close by, given the fact that you were quite far away from your parents when you had your children, when you know, even now being in England. And that has obviously influenced the way you raise your children, and in a positive way in some aspects, because obviously it's been a bit of a blank canvas for you. Sort of can make the rules as you go along without having that influence of someone else saying, "Well, I did it this way. Why don't you do it that way?" And I can sort of empathize with that, because, you know, I mean, both my partner and I, we have our parents here in this country, but they're very, very far away. So we don't see them very often, but, you know, when we do, there is obviously going to be aspects of like unsolicited advice and like, "Oh, I did it this way. I don't understand why you're doing it like this. Like, this worked for me," that kind of, you know, suggestions and things that can have an impact on you, obviously, mentally. And it's a bit of a double-edged sword when you live away from your family, because you want that closeness and you want to be able to, you know, spend family time with them. But also, you know, in other ways, it can be quite positive, you know, being away and then having that really sacred time when you do see them and focusing on just spending quality time together. So that is a really interesting point that you mentioned there.
What's interesting as well is when you think about that generation, you know, we're not comparing the same thing at the same time.
Yeah.
So when they're perhaps watching us struggle a little bit, they go, "Oh, you know, we didn't worry about that." But actually, they probably did. It's just that they've survived it and they don't recall all the bad days like 25, 30 years
on. I really think that's what it is. Like when you think about things like sleeping through the night, like, "Oh, my children slept through the night. Like, I never had any issues." But I don't know, because I do think, you know, after so many years pass, you do end up just nitpicking, you know, bits. You're quite selective in your memory, right? You want to remember all the positive bits, and you might end up then, you know, pushing to the back burner some of your other negative experiences. And it just happens over time, and I'm sure like it will happen to us, you know, in the future, in 10-20 years time. We'll forget all the bad stuff, all the hard stuff, and just remember all the good moments.
I think my mum is incredibly knowledgeable about babies. She's worked in you know, prenatal infertility and postnatal care her whole career.
Yeah.
So she sort of almost like owned all the knowledge of babies that there was to be. And she got really angry at me one day and said, "I'm going to delete all your parenting apps." And I sort of had to tell her I didn't really have any, you know, but she just assumed that I was relying on other people's accessible information.
Yeah.
And I guess she was trying to say, like, have confidence in yourself. But I almost wonder if it was like, actually, why aren't you asking me more questions? And that sense of community. And I wonder if, again, on a different level as well, if we look at the way all of our society is a bit more structured now, you know, there's a massive decline in people participating in active religion, which kind of gave you a natural community as well.
Yeah.
And also people who would just be there to give advice, whether they were directly family or not, or at least a regular contact with people that, you know, might give you a bit more of that village feel.
Yeah, it takes a village. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So I think that maybe, like, I don't, for me, you know, there's nothing replaces a conversation with someone who's going through what you're going through at the same time.
Of course.
A children's centre, you know, coffee groups. Even if you feel a bit awkward getting involved in the first place, you come out of those conversations, I think, feeling probably better than you would doing loads of online research or something, you know. Because, you know, 6 months down the line, you probably won't remember that bad day or that bad phase. But having someone who can recognize it in real time, I think is really important.
Yeah, in real time, and having that sense of solidarity, like, "Oh, someone else is going through this. I'm not alone." Or, you know, if you're particularly concerned about an issue and you think, "Oh, actually, someone else is also going through this. So, you know, I shouldn't feel so anxious or so worried," you know, talking about like illnesses or, you know, ailments that a lot of young children have. And you think, "Oh my gosh, like, what's going on?" But then, obviously, with experience yourself, Gabby, you know, three kids in, it's very different in terms of the confidence that you acquire and just being more laid back. I think the more children you have, obviously, I've only had one child so far, so and he's, you know, 15 months now. So, you know, when you go to a GP or when there's a particular issue, and you know, they always say, you know, "Is this your first?" It's because they sort of know, you're going to be extra anxious and worried because you've not had this experience before. But, you know, with time and with, you know, experience and with knowledge, you do become more confident and more aware and just able to go with your gut instinct, I think, and having that confidence to be able to do so, I think, can be quite challenging the first time around, because, you know, you've never done this. It's such a big, you know, leap in your life that you've just never done before.
Completely. And you think everything is hitting you like a ton of bricks, and you think everything must be perhaps, you know, not normal. Or how do you know? Where do you go for your reference point? I think there's this huge benefit of going through the baby and toddler stage a couple of times beforehand, because there was a few weeks there where my daughter didn't like me very much. You know, she was happy to breastfeed and happy to cuddle, but generally I wasn't very interesting for her. She was really into her dad. And just not being like personally hurt by that, yeah. And just being able to recognize that this is something that happens. This is part of their development. This is part of that. And then not being hurt and not treating her in a way where I was like, well, if you don't want to hug me, I don't want to hug you. You know, like, yeah. Which sounds ridiculous when you take a step back, but just saying, right, this is this. And in a couple of weeks, it will change again. And sort of having that kind of security to know that, you know, all things pass, and mm-hmm. being able to just sort of recognize the stages. I think if you've got your 2-year-old, like when my son was 2, my eldest one, if he hit a kid in the playground, you know, you'd be personally devastated. You would be, oh my gosh, you'd be apologizing. My second son, he got hit by someone, and I just went, oh, it's not okay. Obviously, are you okay? It's okay to be hurt. It's okay to have emotions, but that's not the end of the day.
No,
you know, exactly. you're still friends. And I think that really coming out the other side of that and realizing that these are things that all kids do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we it's about us giving them the framework of what is and isn't acceptable behavior, but it's not a reflection on you. Every bad behavior is not a reflection on you. Every tantrum is not. It's literally part of them trying to understand the world and navigate it.
Mm. Yeah. It's nice having listening to you coming from that level of experience and knowledge as, you know, a first time mom for me, because obviously, you know, as you say, you know, some things that happen, you can't help but take personally, you know, like my son, when he hits someone at nursery, you just think, obviously he's, you know, a toddler and he hasn't got the sense, but as you say, part of their development. And taking things personally when it comes to, you know, if sometimes they have, you know, go through phases, like they have a favorite parent, you know, there are moments where, you know, my son wants to be cuddled or held or, you know, spend time and giggle around his dad and not with me. And I sometimes think, oh, well, what am I doing wrong? Like, how can I make it more fun for you? But then you take a step back and you realize that, as you say, it's a phase, or the next day he'll only be wanting to spend time with me and not that keen on spending time with his dad. So it's an evolution, and they change and develop so quickly that you just, you know, obviously once you've gone through phases or challenges, you look back, as you say, and take a step back and you say, oh, it's so ridiculous. Why did I react like this? You know, it was so childish of me, you know, expecting something like this, some sort of in that kind of emotional development from a baby. But you can't help it sometimes. It's just a natural, I think, response to, you know, having carried and you know, birthed a child for so, you know, the challenge around that, and then having that as their response, you know, so you feel like, oh, you know, why have I done all this for? Was it worth it? That kind of existential question. But I'd say both of us are sort of past that now, by the sounds of it. I mean,
hopefully. I mean, I think there's always sort of, it's about, I think, again, it comes down to confidence. And, you know, if you're okay, if you're getting lots of different advice or being told that you're doing stuff wrong or feeling like you should be feeling bad about it, and having the confidence to go, no, I back myself.
Yeah.
But without having to be so regimented in it as well. I mean, I think it would be really lovely as a society. I think we should have a much wider range of tolerance for people and the choices around growing, birthing, raising kids. Yeah. You know, provided these are obviously in safe and protective environments. But it would be nicer for I know lots of people who have slightly different rules for their kids than we have for ours. You know, ours tend to bath every day because it works for our routine. We've got friends who bath them once a week. Mm. It doesn't matter.
It's varied. You know, it depends. Yeah, very much so. Being respectful of that difference, I think. Very
if things, you know, and I think we can also grow and learn from other people like that as well. So it'd be nicer rather than people feeling like they have to follow certain really strong regimens, which, I mean, if we think back to the 50s, that's what the woman had to do, you know, bed at this time, feed at this time, sleep at this time. You know, having a slightly wider thing and making sure that people are, and when they are struggling or perhaps do have questions, it's okay to ask and it's okay not to have the answer and be able to seek help in that way.
Mm. Yeah, completely agree. I mean, on that, you know, before you, obviously, you have to cast your mind back to a few years ago, but I mean, before, you know, you had any children, you know, what were some of the sort of biggest myths and unfounded fears that you heard about, you know, pregnancy, about birth, about parenthood, like, and how did you overcome them, obviously, over time? And, you know, having now three children, what's the sort of journey been like, you know, going from one to two to three in that respect?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot around, you know, there was a lot, particularly, you know, growing up in the sort of being a teenager in the early 2000s, you know, the amount of body image stuff we had chucked at us.
Oh,
and
yeah.
The idea that you had to, you know, bounce back. I mean, thankfully, no one ever said that to me.
I hate that word, bounce back, snap back.
Oh, it's ridiculous.
I hate those. Yeah, they're horrible.
But I also think there is that, you know, point about, you say, like, be active and stuff, you know, the best thing you can do is be as active as you can and respect your body in that way, so that you'll have the energy on the other side of things. I think, but equally, like, do not push yourself beyond it. It's one of the biggest things you'll ever put your body through. You know, there is a time, there'll always be more time at the other end. Like, I think after I had my second son, I really tried to get out and start running. Quickly, I followed all the right guidance. I, you know, I waited till I had my checkup, and I just, my body wasn't ready for it.
Yeah.
And I really hurt my hip. I tried couch to 5K. I really tried, but actually I just needed more time.
Yeah. You've got to be gentle and kind to yourself. But I think, as you say, it's really hard with a backdrop. You know, there is so much pressure with body image. Even now, like you say 20, 30 years ago, but even now I think it's, there's a certain expectation for people who, you know, have children, and then there's the expectation, oh, you're going to snap back, or you're going to get back to fitness as soon as you can, that kind of thing. But everyone's on their own journey, right? And it depends on your personal circumstances, like your health, your physical ability as well, like how limited you are, and also just your surroundings, like how much help do you have? Because if you want to exercise, you're going to need someone to look after your child, right? And some people don't have access to that kind of help, I suppose.
That is my... Personally, that is my biggest barrier at the moment.
Yeah,
I just don't have the extra time. So, and with working, which I really enjoy, but there's just, I mean, there, you know, big advocates would say there is time and it's 5:30 in the morning. I'm just not there yet. Like, I'm sure there might be a time where I feel like that, but we're still not getting, you know, properly full night's sleep.
So I recognize
that, and I'm like, there will be a time, maybe in like 6 months or a year or 2 years, where I can dedicate a bit more time to that. And I think part of it, again, is recognizing that I do want to do more exercise and have more time for that, but now's not the time. Mm. That doesn't mean it goes off the back burner completely, but just like, be okay with it, rather than trying to beat yourself up that you're not doing absolutely everything. The idea of the every woman is a bit hard.
having it all, as they like.
I remember, so one of the conversations I remember us having before you had Rohan, when you asked about how we managed balance.
Yes.
And I thought, and I remember at the time thinking, you know, well, balance implies some level of zen, that everything is working fine and everything is working perfectly. But it's not, you are spinning plates, but it comes back to priorities and being okay with what you've got time for at the time being. I'm lucky that I've got, like I said, I've had the option to work part-time or compressed hours or flexi time, and those things are invaluable, I think, for overall well-being and just general juggling. But, you know, some things are going to drop. And
that's okay.
You
know, yeah.
That's okay. And just know that you don't want them to drop forever, and make sure you come back to them when you've got a bit more time, rather than, like, you know, sliding into just, as we're saying, getting into like perhaps not doing anything with your evenings because you haven't been able to do anything for your evenings. Well, you know, when babies get a bit older and, you know, they go to bed easier, you can, you know, hopefully you can work it with your partner that you can find some time to go and do something, but it might not happen in the first 2 or 3 years.
Yeah. And just having that, you know, just accepting that, I think there's a level of acceptance, and that's something that I feel like I went in with my eyes wide open before I got pregnant, because I spoke to a lot of people who had kids or who were about to have kids, some of them, you know, with older kids, some of them younger, and, you know, just tried to have a really well-rounded perspective. People who had lots of support, I spoke to people who didn't have any support in terms of, you know, family help and things like that, and then other people who, you know, only had one child and were really sort of focused on career development, and other people who said, you know what, before I had kids, you know, I had a very one-track mind. I wanted to, you know, pursue a high-flying career, but then once I had children, it really shifted my perspective on life, and I wanted to prioritize, you know, family time. So taking account of all of those various experiences, you know, I feel like that helped me. I know some people say, I don't want to know about others' experiences because it might make me more anxious or worried. But for me, that really helped. And generally with pregnancy and like birth, I was like very keen to like hear all the graphic details because I just wanted to know everything. Because I wanted to know what it was like, basically. And I knew that if I didn't, I'd just panic and just be so scared. So when it came to like giving birth, I was just literally prepared for like the worst pain ever imaginable. And I feel like that really helped soften the blow for me, because I know other people are very much like, oh, you know, I've got like a playlist. I'm going to do this, like birth. I'm going to do that. And they have like a long list or like a, you know, detailed description of how they want their birth experience to be. And when they asked me that at my antenatal appointment, I was just like, I don't have one. I don't want a birth plan, because I know that things just get knocked off and you just have, you know, a situation where things go completely off course to what you wanted. And when you have that, you get disappointed. So for me, I was just like, you know what, whatever happens, happens.
I had sort of my mantra was as natural as possible. That as possible could have been absolutely everything that it needed to be. Because you didn't know. And I think that was the benefit of perhaps having members of the family who had worked in, you know, baby birthing in hospitals for so long. You know, I think because the one thing that we have now that perhaps perhaps our mothers, but you know, to a lesser extent, our grandmothers, you know, we do have a power of choice. And it can be really powerful, but powerful in both directions. Like, you know, we're really lucky. We're empowered to have as many pregnancies as we like, or how many children we like with whom. But that doesn't mean it's still not a journey. Not everybody gets that choice, or they don't get the choice that they want. Mm-hmm. And that extends, I think, to when you go to give birth, you think that you are in charge of all of the decisions that might be. I remember going for, I think, the first scan, one of the scans, and thinking it was like a big celebration and that you were there just, you know, it was like a milestone in the pregnancy, when actually very quickly I was like, this is a medical procedure. This is a procedure. There is potential outcomes that aren't positive. Yes. And some people do go through this and have positive, you know, outcomes that aren't positive. And just thinking that was quite sort of humbling, I think, in that sense. So just, being aware. But I remember that first one, like first pregnancy, hanging out for every single doctor's appointment, because that felt like progress, whereas actually it's just you and your body doing your thing. But you needed that external point of telling you, like, this is happening, this is moving.
Yes, exactly. That sort of checkpoints, right, every so often throughout your pregnancy, like the necessity of it. And I mean, I don't know, I've only had one child, but I mean, did you feel like the antenatal appointments in your subsequent pregnancies, did you prioritize them, or did you feel like sometimes you could drop one or two and that be not too much of an issue?
I definitely went to all of them. Like, it was really important. And as I say, I was generally fine in my pregnancy. My babies were all late, all three of them. And so, like, my emotional state by the end of all of them were not very positive, because you're thinking about all the possible outcomes that could happen, you know, up until has happened. I was quite scared of induction. And I think, you know, women who go through that, all power to you.
Really struggle, it's really painful, is what I've heard from those who have said they went through the induction period, or they then end up having a C-section because it's
going through all of that. I mean, my first one, it was a 4-day labor. Everything was textbook on the first day. But he still wasn't here by day 4, and then it was, you know, it was quite a traumatic birth. And then they said, after all of that, they said, we're going to take you to theater and give you an epidural to stitch you up. And I was like, couldn't you have done that from the beginning? You know, you just don't know.
Prolongs the process, the whole process of giving birth. Like, even after that, the fact that you had to then have that epidural, that's crazy.
Well, thankfully I avoided it, but I was like, what if that was on the table the whole time? But
oh my God. Just don't know what to expect. It's every and every person I've spoken to, everyone's had such a different experience. You know, it's not universal.
It's crazy. It's crazy how different it is. Another friend of mine, she has recently had her third, and she went to all of her appointments, and she was getting a bit like, yeah, been here, done that. And there was a problem with her pregnancy, and she had ended up having to have the baby quite early. So those appointments, you know, for her, she was almost like, God, I could have just missed it. Yeah. So it ended up being like a really, important, as I say, healthcare.
Yeah. And we are so privileged, the fact that we have access to that kind of health care, you know, because not many people do. And I just cast my mind back to my grandma, you know, she had, you know, four children all at home, just with her mum. So my great grandma there. And I think there was like a community, like doula or like a midwife type person within their village who like had some experience with childbirth in terms of helping other people and obviously going through the experience herself, but then not actually being, I don't think she was a qualified medical professional, and the fact that she did that and all the risks that, you know, associated with that and what could have gone wrong. Like it just blows my mind that, you know, it was like that, you know, not even that long ago. Like it was what, one or two generations ago. And it's just evolved so much since. But obviously my grandma was in, you know, a different country. She was in Bangladesh. So very, very different perspective. But, you know, people do, you know, now I feel like we've sort of come full circle, haven't we? Because a lot of people now will prefer a home birth, you know, people who've been through, you know, a few pregnancies so that they know what to expect. They say, you know, I actively choose to be able to give birth in the comfort of my own home. And who are we to judge, right? If it's what makes you feel comfortable.
I have huge respect for that. It wouldn't have been the right choice for me, but I very much respect people who do that. Yeah. And I think that comes back to that wide scope of tolerance. If we're safe and the children are protected, then we should be trusted to have those choices.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, with that in mind, I mean, societal norms, I think we've touched upon this already, like they have evolved, but there are certain expectations for parents, you know, balancing personal choice, as we spoke about earlier, with, you know, what the expectations are from society, like when it comes to, you know, having children, being pregnant. You know, I mean, one thing that I was quite worried about actually before I had a child was like the concept of like selflessness and being, you know, having those maternal instincts. Like I never saw myself as a maternal person or someone who was like, oh, so selfless, so giving, like, you know, so nurturing. Like I just never like saw myself as that kind of person. And so I thought I'm not fit enough, you know, to be a mum. Like I'm not going to be able to be a good mother because of it, because I don't have certain qualities, or I didn't think I had anyway at the time. So I think there is still that expectation of, you know, being all giving, being, you know, sacrificial. Like that is, and again, that can be, you know, a blessing as well as a curse, right? I mean, from your experience.
I've got that down. I mean, the way I describe it is having children was the most selfish thing I've ever done. You know, I had children because I wanted to.
Exactly.
You know, it's a very selfless role, and you give up a lot of yourself, like, you know, caring for them. And, you know, my children kind of are the center, and I'm really constantly worried about their emotional needs and are they getting everything they need and their development. But it's okay to feel the pressures of that child raising, you know, even when it's your choice to do so.
Yeah.
You know, you don't anticipate how to navigate a tantrum in the supermarket over Spider-Man undies, like at the point that you're worried about, have I got the most maternal instincts? Like no one's good at all of it.
No. I think you're just giving yourself permission.
So for me, I think about the women who make the decision not to have children. So I'm in my late 30s now, so I've got lots of friends who are sort of reaching that point, or maybe they thought it would have happened for them and it hasn't, or those that are in really stable relationships but they're not sure if they want kids or not. And I feel like one of the societal pressures is it's okay to choose not to have kids, but you have to be really steadfast in that decision. You know, you have to be able to defend it very strongly for about a decade. And I think that is perhaps something that overall we could get a bit more understanding about.
I think so. I absolutely agree. And I do think sometimes, you know, you sort of have your blinders on, right? And you don't think about that. I think we definitely as a society should be a lot more conscientious of those who choose not to have children, because that is a societal norm, right? Having children. It's like, if you don't have it, there's question marks. Why haven't you had kids? You know, why, you're selfish, or, you know, you don't care about, you know, nurturing the next generation, whatever it is, you know, you get things like that thrown at you. And there was definitely that fear in me, before I had children, I thought, oh, am I going to get that? There's that sort of stigma attached to it, right? To people who are without children. So there's so much work, I think, to be done around changing that narrative, especially as more and more people choose not to have children. That's a conscious choice. And that's okay. Like, that is okay if you don't want to have children. And people shouldn't feel
it's okay to be unsure. Okay to be unsure about it as well. Like, you can, you don't have to be a steadfast defender one way or another. Like, you know, the world's a really big, complicated place, and there's lots of reasons why. So I think that, yeah. And for some people, you know, it's not a choice.
And they can't have them, right? So there's that as well. Yeah. Yeah.
So that's something I would like to see, you know, something I think we can all do a little bit better.
Yeah.
That's the way we talk about it. And just if somebody says, oh, I don't know, but I don't think so. That's all, you know, that's entirely fine.
Yeah, completely. But yeah, I mean, cultural, obviously, expectations can have a big influence as well. I mean, you know, my auntie, I've got a few aunties, and one of them chose not to have children, and you know, people still ask her about it today. She's in her 60s, you know, why didn't you have them? And she just said, you know, I got married quite late, you know, I traveled around a lot, I had quite a nomadic lifestyle, if you like, so I just, my lifestyle wasn't suited to having children. I didn't want to raise them in that kind of environment, which is, I think, is, you know, a really conscientious and thoughtful way of looking at it, because, you know, it depends on the person and then, yeah.
It's a huge amount of self-awareness that
it is.
You know, not all of us who have children have that amount of self-awareness when we go into it either. You know,
yeah, absolutely.
It's one of those things that once you're in, you can't really do much about it otherwise.
Yeah. I mean, as working mums, right? I read somewhere the other day saying as well, like, you know, we're expected to work as if we don't have children, and to raise children as if we don't have, you know, work or all the other priorities and things that we need to get done in this life. So there's that as well. And off the back of that, you know, people who don't have children, there's an assumption that, oh, you don't have children, you must have so much free time, like, or even in the working sort of context. Historically, there have been situations I've heard from other people anecdotally, of course, but like, because they don't have children, they're like told, oh, you can't take certain holidays, or you need to do more work, because obviously, you know, the assumption is you must just have a lot of free time because you don't have children, which I think is just such a negative way of looking at it. It's just, you know,
there's no,
say, yeah.
Like, having children does not overvalue your life. Like, it might make it busier, and it might make it, you know, more full on for a certain period. And, you know, employers and colleagues who respect that are invaluable.
Yes.
But that doesn't mean that everybody else, you know, has to take it.
No, exactly. And you know, it has to validate their experience as, you know, not having children, because their time is just
very much so
as anyone else with children. So being receptive to that, and I think that's something that I can also do, you know, myself, better. And even before, you know, I had a baby, I had a really big fear, and I think I just had it even as a teenager, which is just weird, because when you're a teenager, you don't think about having kids, but I did. And I just had this internalized fear, I think, that I couldn't have children. That was like one of my biggest like anxieties in life. And I think it stemmed from my mum, because when she tried to have me, I think she tried for, you know, over 3 years. She couldn't get pregnant for a very long time. And then when they went to sort of do a scan of her ovaries just to make sure everything was okay, she had she had like some cysts or some fibroid, I don't know, but whatever it was like a really big cyst. And they said, oh, we're going to have to remove it in order to, you know, to get you, you know, enable you to get pregnant, basically. And then when she went in for that, you know, procedure, they scanned her and they said, oh, actually, you're pregnant. And it was me. So she got pregnant. And then obviously she went on to have my brother as well. So that was all fine. But yeah, so she was, I think, quite worried. And I remember like having conversations with her as a child, and she used to say to me like, oh, I am worried about you. Like, what if the same thing happens to you, like when you're older? So I think I really internalized that, and I just assumed that the same thing would happen to me. And you know, I had some tests done just to make sure everything was okay. And I just had this, like, I just thought my body wasn't capable of doing something like that, you know? So I had that kind of, and I think that might have even like propelled me, right? It was a bit of a catalyst for wanting to have a child, comparative to, you know, my sort of friendship groups, you know, they're not, you know, I'm one of the first to have had a child. I think that sped the process up for me, whereas other people, you know, my age are, you know, pushing it back a bit further. For those that do, you know, intend to have kids, you know, a bit later, maybe in their mid-30s or so. So
it sounds like that affected your balance of choice, really.
Yeah,
and it sounds not dissimilar to my experience. And my parents got married being told that they couldn't have children.
Oh, wow.
And yeah. Then, but, you know, very textbook 18 months after they got married, there I was, like, my mum had morning sickness and my dad was like, I think you're pregnant. She was like, there's no way. Yeah. And similarly, she went on to have four kids. I personally developed a prolactinoma in my late teens, which is like a little hormonal growth on your pituitary gland, okay, which effectively told my body it was always pregnant.
Oh my gosh.
I would lactate. I didn't get periods naturally. So obviously that was something I had to address in order to get myself to a place where I could be fertile. Which very interestingly, after I've had each child, it's got better and better.
Yeah.
So they've all played little fixets as they've gone through.
So I think the balance for you.
Yeah, well, I always had, you know, the same as you, we always sort of had it, and the experience of my mum working in fertility for 25 plus years, we constantly had that there, you know, don't leave it late, don't waste your time and your chance. And
yeah.
So while there is that choice, you know, there are things that can tip the balance, mm-hmm. you know, if you might try and it might happen instantly for you, or you could try and it could be a couple of years, or you might need medical intervention, you know, you don't really get a say over that.
You don't. You just don't. And it's not to, you know, pressure people to, you know, oh, you know, we'll do it while you're young, so you're more likely, you know, you have a better chance, that kind of thing. Because there are interventions, right? There are opportunities, for example, like freezing your eggs. But then again, that comes from a place of privilege, right? And affordability, like having the financial means and security to be able to, you know, opt for something like that. Other people aren't so fortunate. So being receptive to that as well, I guess. But it all depends. And also, obviously, like, we know it's the cost of living and everything. So kids are expensive as well. So there's that to think about.
I find the early years, you know, if you're working in a job that provides maternity leave and time off, that side of things is not so bad if you've got some cover, because you're there. It's those first few years of childcare that really take their toll.
Yeah.
And then when you get to a stage where they're sort of three or four and can go into, speaking from my experience, into like the state-funded childcare and nursery settings.
Yeah.
But there's that like pinch point right when you start working back, if you go back to work after maternity leave, where your childcare costs are astronomical. And
yeah.
And it's at that point you're thinking, what is the point? What am I working for?
Yeah.
But for me and for my family, the best decision was, well, actually, you know, to take time out, you know, you might not be drastically different financially, but it was the longer I took out, the harder it would be to get back in. And unfortunately, that is still
a
thing.
That's the reality, That's the money penalty,
You kind of get to the point where perhaps you have a job rather than a career for a while, because you're not able to focus as much as you want. You know, it was in a very important meeting yesterday. The nursery called. My daughter was really sick. I had to go. You know, and I was lucky that my work is understanding in that way. But I have to go, and I'm not in the meeting. Like, that's just the consequence of it. That's just the reality. You know, and that's just, and everyone just sort of has to be okay with that for what is in theory quite a small amount of time. But when you're in it, it can feel really overwhelming, and like you'll never be back on full bore. But it does, you know, it does pass. The time does pass.
Yeah, and I think we do put that pressure on ourselves, right? When we do return, for those people, you know, who do choose to go back to work after they have a child, you know, they're so sort of, you know, I mean, I, from personal experience, was very like determined, not just to prove to other people, but I think I was just I just wanted to prove to myself that I could, that I could work and, you know, be able to raise a child. And I still feel like that, you know, I still feel like I need to prove it to myself, to make sure that I'm, you know, doing a good job, being able to do it all. And the fear, you know, of historically speaking, you know, the fear of being held back or feeling like we haven't reached our full potential as a result of having a child, you know, things are getting easier. There are opportunities, you know, childcare costs are, you know, being support, you know, government support to, towards childcare costs is going to make a big difference. Flexible working, as we spoke about earlier, you know, is making a big difference to keeping. I think there was a report actually published recently, or some sort of statistic that came out saying that flexible working has, you know, really kept mothers in particular in work, whereas if they didn't have that option, they probably wouldn't be working. So as you say, you know, sometimes it can just be a job as opposed to being a career. But at the end of the day, that's keeping you, you know, your foot in the door, essentially. And if you take time out of work, it is really hard, you know, if you take up, you know, quite a few years off, say, for example, and then go back in, it's hard to sort of get the cogs turning again, because you're so used to a different kind of context in your life that you forget about the world of work. And I was so scared about that. I didn't want to be in that position, because I saw, you know, that happened to my mum when we were, you know, kids. You know, the burden of childcare really did fall on her. She was the primary caregiver while my dad, you know, was out working full time, and she didn't really get to realize her full potential, even though, you know, she had so much to give. She wasn't able to do that. So I was just so conscious of not having that happen to me. But there is that, you know, how much, because obviously, you know, you only have so much energy in the day, right? Our, you know, energy and our bandwidth, you know, it's finite. We have limited capacity and capability, and it's about how we utilize that, right? So sometimes you might feel like you are giving all your attention to your child if they're unwell, as you say, or if you want to go to a particular experience or do something really fun with them, so you take some time off of work. Or, you know, if you are at work, you might be thinking about them, or if they're particularly unwell, you get a call from nursery, as you say, like that's happened to me a few times now, and you just have to accept it, and you just have to say, I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to, you know, some things are more important, right? But then having that trust with your, you know, wherever you work, and they know that, you know, you're able to get the job done, is also quite important. So that might mean you take some time out, but then when you do come back, you're able to, you know, live up to it, whatever it is that you're doing. So there's that to think about as well, and to contend with. But I mean, I don't know if you found, you know, similar, but it felt similar, especially after having your first, you know, one or two, like feeling like, oh, I need to get back on the horse, basically. Like, I don't want to let that part of me sort of slide, or I don't want to fall into the trap of, oh, I'm just, you know, full-time mothering, I don't have anything else for me. And for me, like, work is an outlet, like it's where I can like do something for me, which is quite funny, because people, so other people say work, like, why is work something for you? You're just working to, you know, make money, essentially. But I don't see it as that. I see it as something for me, genuinely.
Yeah, I think I had had an interesting experience actually when I going on maternity leave the first time around. Was the first time I'd not worked in, like, since I was probably about 14 or 15. So the idea that, you know, that there's a world outside Saturday and Sunday, you know, so in one sense it gave me quite a bit of perspective, and I did go back to work full-time after I had my first son, and I then sort of within a few months, you know, I actually was finding, because I'd been really close to a promotion right before I'd had him, and I'd narrowly missed out. And someone did say to me, "Oh, well, don't worry, you've got bigger things going on in your life right now," which was a bit hard to hear. And it came up again a year later, the job, and I was, you know, then told, "Oh, you're a shoo-in," and I was overlooked again while being on maternity leave. And so when I went back full time. I went back early. I threw myself in. I wanted to show, exactly like you said, prove it to others and prove it to myself that I could do it. And I was miserable because I wasn't feeling respected. The work wasn't being respected. And I thought, no. And I actually thought it made me value my time and my employment more. So I actually left quite soon after going back on maternity leave. One, because I'd been overlooked, and two, I was miserable. I thought, if I'm working, I want it to be valuable. I want to feel like I'm, like it's, you know, it's meeting some level of ambition and is a good use of my time.
Yes,
I think we get, I think as mothers, we get better at valuing that time. Absolutely. Whether it's with or not with our children. So yeah, I went and found another job, and that was interesting. And it did take me like nearly 5 years to make that initial step that I missed out on that first time, which I thought was, you know, that was just something I just had to be okay with it. Like that just was the situation at the time. So I think, but you know, recognizing that value and saying, well, I'm not going to stay here, work really hard and feel miserable about it. I'm happy to be working. But I want it to be, you know, I want it to have some level of satisfaction in it as well. So I think that was a really big thing for me. Another thing I would, reflecting on some of our earlier conversations, is that kind of generational divide.
Yeah.
You do hear a lot, you know, and our mums all, I think, you know, in the generation, all the people that I knew, a lot of them did have to go back to work or had to work quite a lot to sustain the family. And I get from them, you know, don't, you know, the time is precious. Don't rush back to work. Don't, you know, spend all that time with them. But then I also see, you know, a lot of women in their late 50s and 60s who are a bit frustrated that they didn't have the career they would have wanted weren't able, you know, even after their kids are long gone and could still be contributing quite highly in their area of employment and kind of never quite got there and never quite got off the ground. And that's something I've sort of always been battling with. You know, I'll talk to my mum and she'll say, you know, don't throw away this time with the kids. But equally, I know she would have loved a couple of extra steps on in her career.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so it's you know, there's no. And then I also there is no, you know, it is about. I've also heard, you know, your 30s is your time for compromise, and I think a lot of that is perhaps around the choices around children and how your life might look and how you want it to be. It's also interesting looking at women, perhaps where their children are, perhaps in their teens, who still have maintained that kind of that flexible working balance. And I really respect that because they've gone, this is it, you know, this is what I accept, this is what I'm prepared to do, and this is the right balance for me. And again, it might mean that you're not going to be, you know, taking another couple of career steps, but it also means that you're able to be around with the kids. So, you know, again, we should value that kind of happiness balance and the sustainable and, you know, satisfying level of living. I think we can run ourselves into the ground trying to do everything for everyone all the time. And what for?
That is absolutely the key point, Gabby. Like, you know, that's sustainability, like being able to be in that sort of comforting sort of reassurance position where you feel like I have a good balance here. I'm spending, you know, a good amount of quality time with my children, not just time, but actual quality time. But I'm also able to devote some time to something that I want to work on, whether that's, you know, career progression or a particular hobby. And finding that middle ground can be quite challenging, as you know, we know from ourselves and from other, you know, parents that we speak to. But, you know, being able to find that zen, if you like, it is a constant battle. And not knowing, you know, and being pulled from different, you know, different directions. But similar to you, like I've heard stories, you know, from older women who have missed out on those steps because, you know, their career took a bit of a, you know, went on a bit of a sort of back burner because they were focusing on raising their children. So I just sometimes think, you know, the grass is always greener, right? Some people will say, oh, well, I've spent far too much time on my career. And yes, like I've got to where I wanted to go, or, you know, I've exceeded my expectations. But at the same time, the other side of the coin is that, you know, I didn't spend that much time with my children. And people always talk, you know, go back to the whole, oh, like when you're on your deathbed and, you know, you're not going to think, oh, I wish I'd worked more. You know, you're going to be thinking, oh, I wish I spent more time with my family. But then, you know, that's a sort of anecdote that has so many caveats to it, right? Because it all depends on the context and what you value out of life. And obviously family is very important. Having those meaningful connections with people is very important, but it's not just family. It's also, you know, the other people that you encounter in your life, whether that's through work or through other pursuits. Those are important things as well. So there's that to think about.
I think very much for me, I try to focus on, and I don't always succeed, but I try to make, you know, make every day happy, make your life happier. Then hopefully you're doing the right things to facilitate that. You know, it's not just about, you know, hanging out for a holiday or hanging out until the weekends when you might get a rest, like the bigger picture. How do you make the overall? And that can take a little bit of attitudinal shift as well, particularly if you're feeling swamped. I mean, we haven't even talked about like house care and homework. Like it's like that is like it feels like a third partner sometimes.
For the healthcare.
How much work there is, like housework.
Oh, housework! Like, oh my gosh! Yeah.
It's another full-time like it job. Feels. Again, it's something that like it doesn't feel empowering to have to do all the dishes, but somebody still has to do the dishes.
Someone's got to do them. Literally.
Yeah, and so you can feel really overwhelmed and bogged down. And I think taking a step back and finding some, you know, finding the things that are good and valuable, so that you're able to be present and there for the kids and the family and yourself.
Yeah,
as well. Absolutely. So that can be a challenge, but I think it's a worthwhile challenge.
You want to be the best person, right? The best parent for your children. And sometimes that might mean that you have to, you know, dedicate some time to yourself every week, whether that's, you know, going to, you know, whatever hobby that you have or doing something, you know, meaningful that you find meaningful at work, whatever it is that makes you feel, you know, valued and makes you feel like you're making a difference. It's important because at the end of the day, that's what's going to make you happy and be your best self for your children and, you know, your family and friends as well. So there's that to think about. And that's sort of, I guess, part of the wider narrative around reclaiming ourselves, because there's that sort of identity shift, right? When you become a parent, some people, you can get really lost in it, you know, especially the first few months. That's all you do, right? So you sort of lose yourself in that process, and finding that, you know, shift and then being able to go back to who you were. And I don't think that sometimes you feel like you never will, right? And that's fine. Like, I don't feel like I'll ever be the old me, because obviously ultimately I'm responsible for another human being. And that's really important. It's really sacred to me. And I would never take it back, but that changes you as a person. So learning to accept that as well, I think I mentioned earlier, and being sort of, open-minded in that regard.
One of the things as well that I've done, I mean, so I think, being okay with not being able to do everything right now, but not giving up on it is really important. Another thing that was a big change for my husband and I think maybe like a year or 2 years ago, we just sort of embraced what it was. So embraced the chaos. So rather than being like grumpy that we didn't get a sleep in on the weekend, like getting up, we're all down at rugby, we're all down at football. It wasn't so much like, oh, who has to take the kid here and who has to do this. It's more like, right, this is what we're doing this time as a family. So it can be a bit of forethought and planning, but it's just how you approach these things. So some things that we've done to keep the motivation up is after Christmas and New Year's, where the kids watch a lot of TV or play a lot of games and we're not maybe in a good routine, the last few years we've had January games night, and it's to remind us like, okay, turn the TV off. Every night in January, we play card games or board games together.
Every
and
night,
the kids
that is
love it.
Serious dedication. That's amazing.
It just helps us sort of reset the tone of what it is we want to spend this time with them doing. Or like we book a free visit to something like the Sky Garden or something, you know, and just book it in a couple of weeks in advance. And then it's in the diary, and then you make the world fit in around you. If it's movie night, like then we get everyone excited, get the blankets, get the snacks, and try and make it, you know, those sort of family community type things as well. So you're getting some enrichment out of those rather than just feeling like you're in service all the time.
Or that you're in like some sort of autopilot, right? You're just doing things.
Yeah, it's very easy to get into autopilot. Whereas like, you know, they really want you to be present as well. And sometimes that takes being an interesting, well-rounded person, having a hobby. And that hobby doesn't just have to be like exercise. So I've done a choir over the last 6 years on and off.
Amazing. I think you mentioned this before, actually. How is that going? I feel like you've not spoken about it for a while.
It's so fun. I did the term up into Christmas and we did an amazing concert. It's all about having fun. It's all about giving it a go. It's about 10-week terms. You go along, learn the songs one night a week, and then you have a big concert at the end. It's very fun. This term, I've taken a term off because I was finding that my plate was getting a little bit full.
But
that was the right decision because I want to go. I want to be able to really bring myself when I go and have that time and hang out with other people. I don't want to feel like it's a job or a burden.
Yeah, we're sure.
And then I'll look at the summer term, perhaps I'll feel a bit freer again and be able to rejoin it. So having those kind of things where you can, you know, you can sort of moderate what you've got the time and energy for is really important.
Yeah. And I mean, to round off the conversation, we should leave off on, I think, a positive and optimistic note. We've spoken about quite a lot of stuff, actually, you know, positives, the challenges, joys, you know, opportunities. We've spoken, I think the conversation has been quite well-rounded from what I can remember. But I guess the sort of finishing note might be around, you know, how do we sort of enjoy and thrive in motherhood? And I imagine that your perspective has, you know, been quite up and down over time. Obviously, like when, for example, if you look, you know, back to your having your first child and then your second and then going for a third, and how that's changed your perspective, and obviously having to adapt to that and finding a way to, you know, think about all the goods and the positives. And also, you know, having that self-awareness and knowing that things aren't going to be amazing and perfect, and just having that level of acceptance, I guess, as well. Does that sort of play into your, I guess, positive sort of mental outward thinking on a day-to-day basis?
I think so. It's, I mean, I'm hopefully an optimistic person a lot of the time, but I'm also a bit of a realist. Yeah, yes. I mean, I think you have to be. You'd be a fool not to be. I mean, it was quite interesting. I think, you know, you never know if something's going to be the right or wrong decision for your family until you do it. I mean, it was certainly was a bit of a choice to have a third child, particularly with a bit of a gap. So there's over 4 years between the younger two, which kind of straddles the pandemic and the lockdowns. But we both were sort of like, oh, yes, we might regret it if we don't. And we were really lucky that that was a choice we can make. We certainly feel now like, you know, I'm learning the difference between could and should in terms of, you know, like it feels like we're quite complete and we're quite happy. But there's the other things. Like I think when I was, you know, a couple of months before I had the third one, we were all out on bikes. So mum, dad and the two boys all on bikes, and then thinking, oh God, what have we done? We're going to be going back again. Starting on over again. So then finding things that are right for all of us. But I think, you know, I think it's been really, really positive for us, even though it means, like, you know, if you think about the burden of work and childcare and all of those kind of things has increased again, it's right for us, and just trying to find the way that everybody's needs are being met as much as possible, like their emotional needs, that we're able to give each of them enough time that they need as well. And I think that's probably one of the biggest things, as I try and, you know, I tell my kids I've got three jobs. One, the first one is to keep you safe. The second one is to help you become a good person. And the third one is to keep your body fit and healthy. Aww. And everything I do comes under one of those three things.
Yeah.
And it kind of helps me justify why I make the decisions around parenting, why there's boundaries, why we say thank you when we get off the bus. You know, like, so they always come under that. I find that quite useful for me as well. If I need to center myself, or I'm getting upset, or I'm getting like really angry, why am I angry and what is it I'm trying to enact?
Yeah.
And then I can sort of explain to them, this is why I do the things I do.
Yeah. It's always good to have, you know, your workings out, as they say, like explaining things, because kids are so inquisitive. They always have so many questions. I mean, I remember as a kid, even I remember my brother like constantly asking questions and responding to, you know, an answer to a question with another question. It would just never end. Mm. And it's good to have those in your back pocket, right? To be able to justify and explain why things are the way they are, especially when, you know, as they get older, they'll, you know, might notice something, an injustice or something that's not quite right, or sits quite right with them, and they might query and say, you know, why is this happening, or why is this, you know, a reality? And you won't always have the answers, I suppose, but, you know, being able to give them something that they can take away and learn from, I think, is really important. I think that's a really good note to leave this podcast on. So thank you.
I think I'm learning very much that you can't, sorry, one more thing.
yeah, go on.
There's no way to do it perfectly.
No.
So you need to be, you know, you're either going to be too involved or not involved enough, particularly as they get a bit older. So, but making sure that you're trying to respond to their emotional needs as much as possible, I think is the really, is probably the key thing that I can try and do and just be there as much as they need at any given time, or try and give them a bit more rope when they are, when they need it, when they don't. So those are the, trying to be live to those issues rather than what might be the actual, you know, issue of the day.
Yeah, I completely hear that. And part of that, I guess, might even stem from, even whether it's conscious or unconscious, but from unlearning things that happened to us in our childhood, in the way that we were parented or the way we were cared for, right? There are some things that you, you know, might reflect back on. I don't know if you do this, but I've done this and thought, you know, actually, when I, you know, as my child gets older, I want to do things a bit differently. I want to be more receptive to this particular emotional need, for example, because, you know, for me, that didn't work, you know, that well as a child, or I could have benefited from a bit more, you know, awareness around this particular issue. So I do feel like there's that aspect to it as well, like being conscious about things that you want to change or do differently is really important. And that's how you sort of, you know, break those sort of generational traumas or like issues and cycles, I guess. So that's something to bear in mind as well, I'd say.
Yeah, I mean, my eldest son has recently been diagnosed with ADHD. And he just would have just been written off as a kid.
Yes.
I think if he was growing up in the night, he just would have been a bad egg.
Yeah, literally. That's how they were labeled or like put into a different type of school, you know, if just because they had a slightly different way of looking at the world. And yeah.
But he's lovely. And I mean, it's been grueling at times, definitely. But, you know, we're just grateful that his school, and we've got a bit more understanding of the neurodivergence, and we can be like, even if he's being an absolute nightmare, it's, you know, there's something on the other side. That's not everything there is about him, and we can't only treat that aspect of his personality. But so it's being responsive to things like that.
Well, thank you so much for your time. As a parent of three, juggling that with work and all the other things, all the, you know, after school clubs and the weekend activities that you do, just wanted to say, you know, a really big thank you for giving up your time and talking to me so openly and candidly about your experiences. And I really hope that the listeners, you know, take away some positives from this as well.
Yeah, yes. Always happy to talk about my kids.
Thank you so much for listening to Brown Don't Frown podcast. If you know someone who you think might like this episode, please do let them know about it. If you enjoyed this podcast, please do leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. And make sure you hit the subscribe button and you'll be notified as soon as a new episode goes out. Producing and hosting this podcast is done by me on an entirely voluntary basis. So if you do enjoy listening, please consider supporting it through Patreon so that it can continue to provide you with engaging and meaningful content. If you would like to donate, you can do so by heading over to patreon.com/browndontfrownpod. If you have any thoughts or comments or would like to get in touch and contribute to the podcast, do drop us a line at browndontfrownpod@gmail.com. We hope you enjoyed listening.